Blog Talk Radio. This podcast is brought to you by PEMCO Capital Management. PEMCO Capital Management provides an institutional platform for accredited investors to gain exposure in niche sectors within the distressed residential mortgage and real estate markets. Visit PEMCO Capital Management on the web at www.pemco-capital.com. Now your host of Capital Markets Today, Louis Amaya.
Welcome to the podcast. This is Louis Amaya with Capital Markets Today, and thanks for tuning in. Today we'll be discussing a California law that went into effect called SB 1079, which, among many things, allowed nonprofits to last look at all foreclosure sales in California with the objective of promoting home ownership. Joining me today is Tim Hayes, Manager of Distressed Assets for Southside Community Development and Housing Trust. Southside was a participant in the program, and Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Louis. It's really great. I think that the time of this podcast could not be better.
I agree. Before we start talking about SB 1079 and housing in general, there was an article that was recently published by a local NPR office in the Bay Area that highlighted a few of the assets that Southside purchased through SB 1079. The article itself was a, you know, a decent article, but slightly one-sided on some of the outcomes and didn't really describe the full impact of the transaction had on the purchasers of the properties. So I'd like to review, I think there was three properties there, but one thing I wanted to note for listeners, the SB 1079 law was put in place to give a fair shot for owner, potential owner occupants, and tenant occupants to purchase homes at foreclosure sale. But what many of our listeners probably don't know is that in order to do that, you have to come to the foreclosure sale with 100% cash.
Right.
So I'd like to have that up front while we discuss some of these outcomes that we were Southside was able to achieve through SB 1079.
Louis.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's totally fine. And it shows that this is not scripted, which is cool. So I think that we've learned. You know, because, I mean, we've been doing this stuff with HUD for a while, you know. So, again, that was, you know, articles can be articles. But I think that was, from my perspective, a significant oversight is our historic success with HUD. And again, you know, not only are there issues with the owners coming up with 100% of financing, but also nonprofits, you know, in most days, you know, we're trying to do blocking and tackling of community needs. So that was one of the big pieces why we started HUD. And that's one of the things I really want to stress on this podcast is that we just didn't wake up one day and all of a sudden just started, oh, we're going to do this. We have an incredible track record with HUD and their distressed asset sale program, HECM sales, let alone, and all of that was a byproduct of our 30-plus-year history, and we've just developed capacity. So, you know, I'll kind of allow the podcast to continue, but I think that's the one piece that concerns me the most is the article. It was written, but it seems to try to emphasize a few number of transactions versus the hundreds and the multiple states that we've done this in without any issue. So I just wanted to kind of plug that in before, before we kind of just start addressing, you know, these properties. But Louis, thanks for allowing me to kind of plug that in.
Absolutely. I meant to get your feedback on Southside and your history on that. So thanks for giving us that information. So one of the properties that was highlighted in the article is a triplex purchased in Northern California. Can you explain how that transaction played out during the acquisition and the selling of the property?
Yeah, and so, Lewis, I mean, one of the things that when we started with all of this, HUD made it very clear that home ownership was the opportunity. So we always had an emphasis in doing outreach to what I kind of call the occupant, because for what right, wrong, and indifferent, they're in default of a note of some type. So again, you know, that's just kind of standard operating procedure for us. We reach out, we try to do a cash for keys, but often, you know, if the individuals are willing to engage with us, you know, we've used our credit counseling, a model where, hey, they can submit data to us. We can, and I think we use CounselMax, right? And so, again, that then gives us true clarity as to, well, hold on a second. They can stay, they cannot stay. But in this model, and I think it was in Richmond, California. Think of that, Richmond, Virginia, Richmond, California. We couldn't get movement. You know, they didn't want to submit anything. They didn't respond to our cash for keys request. So, as unfortunate as it was, then, you know, we've got to kind of begin our normal process of repurposing the asset. And that means, hey guys, we hate to kind of notify you. We try to do cash for keys, try to communicate with you. So we've got to do, you know, consider eviction options. So not long thereafter, a land trust group called us, and it was just a slow process. I mean, and so, but we were patient. You know, we sold the property dramatically, and if my memory serves me correct, we sold the property to them $200,000 under the value of it. And I'm going to kind of have some interjections in between. So would a normal flipper have done that, or would they just say, hey, here's what we're going to do? I don't want to over exaggerate. I know 90 to 120, maybe even 150 days for them to close. And again, this was the issue that the nonprofit was having. You know, how do they get financing in place? But we waited. And in the article, you know, often I noticed that the article presented, oh, wow, look at how much Southside made. Oh, wow. Well, you know, when we're in that window, guess what? The mortgage was delinquent, interest. You know, we've got to cover the cost of that. And so I went back and looked at the accounting of it, and we made about $643. So, you know, there was, and I think that in the articles, that, well, they couldn't, you know, be angry at us for what we charged them for. But I think it's one thing to say, oh, this is what we made. I think that the outcome was good, maybe not great, because, again, we have, as an organization, we've always focused on home ownership possible. So the great news is that the people remained in place. But I think that because of the structure, which, hey, you know, they agreed to, we know that in America, one of the greatest ways to build wealth is through home equity. And in the structure that they're in, they will never get the type of equity if they purchase both the home and the land. And that's not to, you know, not to belittle any organization's focus, but I think that, and we'll talk about this later, where a lot of the modifications that have happened to SB 1079 is that there's a house crisis in America where lower, moderate income individuals have difficulty getting into homes to build equity. So I think we did what we could. We were patient. We communicated with them well, you know, and I think that there was some conversation about eviction notice. One of the issues is that immediately when the land trust said, hey, we want to do this, we were in constant communication about them. And we just say, hey, if you guys are serious about this, we won't take any action. And I think the records show no actions were ever taken. So, I've kind of talked about that one enough, but I think that the article had an emphasis, well, not an emphasis, but presented information. We just want to make sure that everybody sees the entire transaction and the outcome. So,
yeah. You know, and this goes to what we're going to talk a little bit later and the value that nonprofits can provide as a conduit between purchasing a home for cash at foreclosure sale,
right,
and being that vehicle that can provide down payment assistance, can sell under market value, has patient capital, and really strives to get the outcomes. And like you mentioned, this outcome is a good outcome because we kept the occupants in the home. And as you mentioned, the outcome for the occupants, not so great because they'll never own the land if they ever get a chance to purchase that. They're going to be renters, which is something that we know housing nonprofits on affordable housing focus on home ownership. That's the value, like you mentioned. That's how you build generational wealth. A second property the article discussed was a home in Thousand Oaks, where Southside had acquired the property at foreclosure sale through 1079 when the second went into foreclosure. Explain this transaction?
Okay, so we agree, right, that the second arrived at foreclosure because he stopped making payments, right? And so we purchased the second, you know, that was foreclosed at auction. So, again, we worked with him to pay off the second so he could buy the home back. And, you know, Southside, you know, from my perspective and looking at, the details, because, again, you know, we've got a lot of transactions that we do, but we sold it back to him at like a $200,000 under market value, you know, giving him about 20% equity. So, again, I think that we focused on home ownership, him remaining in the property, and we saw it as a great outcome. And again, we always try to align our mission with the need of private capital that we've often had to use in acquiring these properties. And so it would be great. And this is one of the things that, you know, I kind of go on a little rabbit trail. You know, Lewis, one of the things that kind of really pushed Southside to begin to explore with HUD was not the nature of, oh, wow, we've got a big bucket of down payment assistance, and then banks are ready to kind of, because, I mean, the loan to values are there, but when the properties are more speculative, we've had difficulty in getting traditional capital sources to play in that space. Those capital providers, such as banks and, you know, and others, and they have very low thresholds for returns. And so we just, again, see, this as a great outcome, but we don't have a $1 billion of grant funds that we can leverage to cover overhead and these type of things. So in transactions, we do have to make money, but we also make major concessions in pricing. Both in every example that we've looked at, we've made major concessions with the goal of the individual or family or the unit of that are present to remain in the home.
Exactly. What we're starting to see is a theme, right, of keeping the tenant, owner, occupant in the house, which, again, was the objective of SB 1079. But I don't know if – I know from my perspective, and you can give me your input on this, how easy is it to raise capital for you to participate in these nonprofit carve-outs when the requirements at the federal level and the state level requires the nonprofit to have a majority ownership or control?
Yeah, so Lewis, that's a great question. And so, again, I'll point back to when we got started with HUD. Man, it was an incredibly enlightening but also challenging opportunity because you've got the balance of the needs of private capital to produce a return on investment, and then we've got the nonprofit mission. And so we were really fortunate to have HUD to kind of guide us in that process. And much of what we did was based on that. But, I mean, Lewis, over the years, I mean, we've gone from Florida to California to, I mean, I can't recall all of the events. I remember meeting the Bain Capital one time. We were in Philadelphia, and actually, you know, Diane and I, we went to a HUD event where we were actually participating in the presentation, and that night we had dinner with Bain Capital. Man, we were so stoked. We were like, wow, we're going to get about $20 million. We can really make this thing happen. It didn't happen, but again, not as easy as everybody thinks, and I think, you know, groups like Copar Espanol, others, that are participating at a federal level can also speak to this, because nonprofits know just how difficult it is to raise capital to do more speculative type transactions. And let alone, it's just phenomenal. And then let alone, you know, what a lot of people don't really take in the fact that, and again, I'm not one to overstate, but I mean, you know, we had significant legal counsel, legal fees, a lot. And I want to say, man, we invested almost like 16 to 18 months just getting documents prepared and blessed so that with HUD. So it's a lot of work to it, and it's not just a turnkey where you walk in, oh, hey, this is just what happened tomorrow. So,
from my experience, you know, the two hurdles in raising capital for nonprofits carve-outs is, you know, investors get very nervous about not having control of the entities that are acquiring the assets. So everybody needs to understand the nonprofits have control of these entities, and for an investor to give money and give that up, it's not an easy capital raise.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's not cheap. They charge for that. So a lot of people think that impact funds, oh, they're getting money at 1%, or, you know, no, generally the capital is much more expensive because of the fact they have no control ultimately over the entities that are acquiring these assets. So just to summarize on the property in Thousand Oaks, the gentleman who owned the home stopped making his payment. Southside acquired the second after closure sale, so took the property subject to the first. Southside was contacted by the owner wanting to buy the house back, and spent time and effort to get him the house, get him the ownership back to the house at under market value, similar to the Richmond property at under market value. So we're starting to see a theme here on how these outcomes are benefiting. And oddly enough, the individuals, I would imagine, in these transactions, they're not in a great spot, right, because they just got foreclosed on. So these transactions, even though they're getting a good outcome, their view of things are I guess, maybe skewed by the fact that they feel like not good because they just lost their home. But ultimately, this was a great outcome for this individual and for the land trust.
Right. And what article was that the guy kind of quoted, it was like they were holding the deed over his head. And, you know, again, we always work to clarify, you know, the interest in staying in the property. We worked to an agreed upon price. and we achieve by him remaining in the home and still having equity in it. And so, and I also think too, some of the response is the fact that people kind of have a mindset of about a nonprofit, you know, meaning, oh wow, nonprofits just give everything away. And this is and the reality of what we're doing with HUD and others is private-public partnership. So whereas we remain committed to our mission of home ownership, but because it's private, public-private partnership, it then just creates a different dynamic where we just don't have the grant funding to give everything back to everybody. So, you know, I could understand, to your point, how he felt in an odd spot, but again, our objective has always been to communicate accurately, communicate clearly, and work to an outcome in that if the person can't stay, we'll do cash or keys. You know, we do all these kind of things because, again, our history is we understand the impact of housing. So I'll kind of leave that one alone. So
I agree. And we're going to touch on this a little bit later, but you're right. With public-private partnership, it's a double bottom line, and there's a fine line where you're managing. You need to keep the investor engaged so you can continue right. your mission while also achieving right. the outcomes. So you can build a sustainable model that's not relying on grants and government handouts. You're doing this and generating revenue to keep your mission going while achieving the outcomes. The last property I want to discuss that was highlighted in the article was a home in Joshua Tree. This is an interesting one. Why don't you take a deep dive into this one?
Yeah. So here's the reality of it, right? Her parents owned the home, and she was renting it. You know, nothing wrong with that at all. But something happened along the way where her parents stopped making payments. So we purchased it at foreclosure. And again, I'm trying to make sure I don't say any names, so that's I apologize for the pause. The renter reached out to us wanting to purchase the home. Again, in those situations, she right, wrong, and different, she couldn't get money. But we didn't act in a way, hey, you know what, we want to evict you, you got to get out. Again, our emphasis was home ownership. So she finally got financing in place, and I think she might have used a federal program to get it. But we also know that that federal program was going to do an inspection, and the house was in such a level of disrepair. Could have never bought it, right? And so again, what I think was missed in the article was that, you know, again, we sold it for like $150,000 less, you know, under market. And when I read the article, I kind of got the sense of she tried to assert that she didn't know that the repairs were there, but again, if your financing is going to do an inspection, you've lived there. It's your parents' house. You know what's going on. So again, we ended up waiting again another period of time so that the repairs could be done, and then the house can be sold. So you know, from that perspective, again, we thought it was an outstanding outcome. You know, a legacy property, your parents owned it, you were renting it, your parents lost it, we were patient, we worked with you, and now you're back in the property. And the reality is we sold a property for less than what it was worth, you know, on a market value perspective. And so I think in that space, again, you know, great article. And Lewis, I think that, you know, one of the things that when I kind of look at the properties highlighted in the article, you know, there's kind of a common theme that was achieved. You know, everybody that was in the house ended up back in the same address, you know, and in two instances, they remained homeowners. In one instance, they, you know, the model flipped. And then everything that we sold was under market value. So it wasn't as if we were not at least attempting to pursue a win-win type of opportunity, you know, so from that perspective. So that's just kind of my little takeaway on that, you know, from that perspective.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, the theme is people stayed in the home. Southside took the time to work through several different hurdles in each one of those three transactions to keep the tenant or owner occupant in the home, two, which purchased them back, and again, one went to the land trust. What was really interesting to me in the article was the mention of property flippers and how they're upset about this. And the article seemed to pose it like, well, they should be upset or that they had some viable cause, but I see the irony in this. What do you think the irony is in stating the property flippers were upset that nonprofits were picking off assets that they historically were able to purchase?
Yeah, and you know, and so if we look at the flipping world as a whole, you know, they are doing it. Flippers do it to put, you know, put food on their table. You know, outside of what we did, you know, SB 1079 created a carve-out opportunity for nonprofits. So I know that, you know, I can't speak to any flipper specifically, but in most instances, when you look at flippers, and let's just use HGTV, right, you rarely see a flipper talking to the former owner. It's all about, oh, wow, this property's empty. We're going to spruce it up. And, wow, we've made this much over it. And, again, I think that kind of unbeknownst to the article, to the writing of the article, every example they gave, it wasn't a flip. You know, and so, again, you know, flippers, that's how they make their livelihood. If I was a flipper, I would be again SB 1079, you know, just being honest. But I think that there is a bigger picture than just what do flippers want when we are in an environment of incredible housing crisis from Richmond, Virginia to Richmond, California.
You know, what I see, what really jumped out at me is the property flippers that were mentioned. If they had acquired the three properties that we just discussed, the occupants, tenants, would have been evicted immediately and the property sold at full market value. So
right.
That's ironic to me, right? They mentioned the flippers like they're some type of, you know, flippers are flippers. I mean, they do what they do. But I can tell you, I've been in this space a long time, work with a ton of flippers. And they don't do what Southside did of those three properties. Those people would have been on the street very quickly, and the properties, because these all happened last year. Last year was a hot housing market.
Right.
Selling for under market value last year is incredibly stoic, I would say. Because, again, when when you're managing to the bottom double line, you know, you're fighting the outcomes with the investor returns. And I could imagine your discussion with investors on these, on making sure that Southside hit the outcomes that were necessary because of the mission-oriented process that you guys have that have been doing this for years. So the mention of the filters just kind of was like, whoa, that's really interesting. So those were the only three properties that were, I believe, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, again, you know, as and I realize that we are addressing these, but you know, one of the things I want to kind of remind our listener is that we've been doing this with HUD, 2017, 2008, and our asset acquisition size is far greater reach, multiple states, and I just find it unique that we've never had an issue with a federal agency that has a whole group that monitors this stuff, but now this article kind of comes out. And so, again, not that an article doesn't have a right to be written, but again, just from my perspective, I'm just not sure that, from my perspective, I just want to make sure that everybody understands the total activity that Southside has done, not just identify 2 to 3 assets and all of a sudden now organizationally we are a bad actor. I do not agree with that.
Yeah, that's an interesting statement, because what Southside has done, even though the law in California did not require it, Southside adhered to the federal guidelines of nonprofit eligibility and reporting. Southside is a 501c3. You don't have to be a 501c3 to do this. You don't have to have housing experience to do this. And you don't have to report and be transparent on your outcomes. So Southside follow all the federal guidelines when they didn't have to, completely transparent, obtained affidavits on about 90% of the properties that have been sold, posted it.
Right.
Anybody can go to the website and see the outcomes that have been achieved. That in itself proves to me Southside's credibility and professionalism that is in this space, because these carve-outs are not a new thing. This is not a new concept.
Right.
The federal government's been doing for 15 years, which, you know, Southside has a long storied history with them. What listeners, I think, don't understand how sophisticated housing nonprofits have become. And I would imagine Southside is a medium player at the federal level. There's other nonprofits that have acquired several hundred million over the last 6 or 7 years and are managing assets nationwide. So I think there's a paradigm shift to some extent on how nonprofits can be engaged in private-public partnerships and make a difference, and all the money's just not coming from grants and the federal government. Which kind of leads us to the second piece of the podcast, which, you know, I'm glad we had a chance to go over those three assets and clarify the outcomes and the benefits to those folks that had purchased that asset. But on to SB 1079, we talked a little bit about this up front. Why is it so important that housing nonprofits stay in this conduit position between paying cash and then selling to an owner occupant with financing?
Yeah, you know, and Lewis, again, I think that, you know, the much of the analysis has been done at the federal level by HUD, right? And their team is incredible, and I think that the one common theme is that when the nonprofit is engaged and the nonprofit is the conduit, you maintain a home ownership focus. It can't just be, well, hey, let's just sell this for, you know, more than what it's worth, because it's all about the bottom line. And so that's one of the big pieces. That, you know, and nonprofit in the model, and all I can do is speak to our model and other models that we see happening at the federal level, is that we have a tendency to hold it for a longer period of time, you know? And in a ideal model, what a great thing is if we could provide down payment assistance and then sell it at less than market rate. So, again, you know, the nonprofit can then look at, you know, the tenant occupants to see, hey, well, we do home, you know, we do credit counseling anyway. So, hey, come on in, come and talk to us. You know, so I think that there are and here's the thing that just kind of, I think the best way to kind of describe it is that the nonprofit enters a private-public partnership for the purpose of providing wraparound services. And it is those wraparound services that then focus on, let's keep them in the home, hey, and even like in listings, you know, can we price it in such a way that we might be able to do workforce housing or, you know, something of that nature. But I think that that's the benefit of having nonprofit at the table, because it makes it more of a socially focused fund versus just a socially focused fund with wraparound versus just sales at a high
expense. You know, from my perspective, SB 1079 wasn't perfect. There was a lot of loopholes that needed to be closed up. What I know we've been pushing for from day one, I think I had conversations with United Trustee Associations and some other advocates that immediately got to require a 501c3. 501c3 needs to be in existence for at least 2 years so the nonprofit not been started just to get into the program, must have housing experience, and must report on outcomes. Those four requirements being put in would cut out a lot of the investors who have started nonprofits. I mean, Southside has been doing this for a long time and obviously is not one of those investors, or I'm sorry, one of those nonprofits that just started randomly to jump in this game. From my perspective on the law, it was a good step forward. We needed to put some rules in place to solidify the eligible bidder as true nonprofits, and the structure was set up where the nonprofit always has control. But the affordable housing in California is a little bit of a misnomer. There's not much affordable housing unless you're forcing someone to live in a really bad neighborhood or very, very rural. So for me, the paradigm shift, we were halfway there, getting the housing stock into nonprofits' hands. The second piece of that, which I know we were working on, was, okay, now how do we get scale down payment assistance to attract more low to moderate income buyers? That's the tricky part in California. And we were halfway there, and unfortunately, if AB 1837 passes, we're taking a step back, because I know several nonprofits were already working on that second piece of the puzzle. So again, the one bill doesn't solve anything. It's a process, and you take one step at a time and keep moving it slowly further and further, very similarly to what HUD did over the last 15 years.
So Lewis, you know, as we can't, you know, just because of the ambiguity, again, you know, everything we followed HUD guidelines and it made it simple, right? And so, it was in California law, there was significant ambiguity, you know, and where there's lack of clarity, you know, people can draw their own conclusions, right? And so, but we did have some nonprofits that kind of said to us, hey, how are y'all doing this? And we were like, okay, hey, so here's what you do and here's how you do it. So we had great conversations with several nonprofits about what we were doing. We just kind of felt at that time that just due to the lack of clarity, you know, the swirl around, you know, some of the feedback we were getting, we were like, you know what, organizationally, we're just going to step back from this until the legislator can, you know, can kind of figure out who, when, and where. But, you know, in the article, I give the article credit, it did document the fact that, you know, we just kind of agreed to just not do anything with SB 1079 until there's greater clarity. And I think just right now, you know, organizationally, with all this kind of, you know, kind of trying to portray us in a certain way, we would be, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, done with it, because the thing I don't want to have is now, out of our many, many years of work, We're talking about three transactions, and now all of a sudden, and I kind of use this recurring theme, is that all of a sudden Southside is a bad actor. And again, you know, when an article is written, you can't really question a person's intent, right? I have no reason to understand why this article was written in the way that it was, and what was the desired outcome, other than to paint Southside with a kind of a certain perspective. But why paint us that way? And again, I think that as we look at AB 1837, I think I now understand the impetus, in my limited opinion, not casting shade on anybody else, as my kids would say. But I could also see why maybe the emphasis was on nonprofits finding loopholes. There were no loopholes. We followed the law. So I'll kind of leave it alone. But because, again, I don't want to get into the point where we're, you know, oh, these people are bad. They're not bad. Everybody has a right to their opinion. Our purpose is to, you know, clarify our understanding. Here's what we did. Here's why we did it. And here's where we think opportunity, you know, may move forward. So,
it's essentially the three answers that were selected for the article that you know, had a certain slant to it. Those are excellent outcomes. That's the whole purpose of the program, is to keep owner occupants or former owners or tenant occupants in the homes and sell the homes back to them. So I was a little confused as well. I'm like, whoa, these assets are great outcomes. Unfortunately, because of the vagueness of the law, you know, when they say bad actors for nonprofits, they're lumping in the flippers that created nonprofits in one day and started participating, which is why we've been, from day one, been advocating you need a 501c3, you need tiers of assistance, you need housing experience, and you need reporting outcomes or even reporting requirements. I know when back in the neighborhood stabilizing outcome days with HUD, they actually required 50% of the portfolio to go to one of seven neighborhood stabilizing outcomes. And that, I'm sorry?
We had to do quarterly reporting.
And quarterly reporting. So, again, I think, unfortunately, California was kind of new to this whole concept, and I tried to get with, again, the UTA and some of the other associations to say, hey, look, the law is missing this. It's gonna be a little nutty the first year if you don't put these things in place. And sure enough, unfortunately, it caused issues for some of the authors of the bill. But the answer, in my opinion, is not 1837. 1837, there was a press release recently put out by the National Diversity Coalition basically stating that 1837 creates renters, not homeowners. So the original bill was to create home ownership, whereas now, if 1837 passes, then we'll actually know in a few days, the nonprofits who acquire these properties are now subject to a 30-year deed restriction. So they can sell the home, but they keep the land. To me, if you wanted to buy a property in Mexico, that's what you have to do. You can buy the home, but not the land. To me, that just seems like such a out of left field no sense. And also, it's statewide. So I can see, you know, in densely populated areas where they're focusing on just getting people housed. Yeah, maybe that makes sense. But in the suburbs, rural areas, know, we focus on home ownership. And there's multiple strategies that can work, as long as you have good guardrails around everything. So, you know, I know we've been involved with the National Diversity Coalition, PEMCO has, and to help the senators understand what this bill is proposing. We don't think it's the answer. We think the answer is tightening up the nonprofit and maybe allow the land trust to do this type of transaction, but also allow housing nonprofits to focus on home ownership, generating generational wealth for those who have lost properties say, in the last crash, get back home, rebound buyer, I guess you're calling.
Yeah, and Lewis, I think if we look at a federal, at the federal level, right? Again, you know, I think there's a benefit, you know, to looking at the federal level. So, man, you have an incredible mix of nonprofit, as you kind of noted earlier, participating in this space, right? So you've got, you know, you've got groups like New Jersey Community Capital. I mean, where is CDFI? You know, they're buying the distressed asset. You know, and I always butcher their name because my Spanish is horrible. But you know, you got, you know, Hogar Espanol, you know, Marco, you know, again, an organization focused on housing, advocacy, wraparound services. So, you know, my only concern, and again, I don't have a dog to fight, you know, in the legislature, but again, I think that with AB, you know, 1837, it does take kind of an emphasis toward a certain type of transaction. And I think that, again, the emphasis should be more of a HUD-level type approach in that, does the organization qualify? Does their disposition plan make sense? How do we make sure that they have proper reporting? How transparency? Because I think one of the things we got to realize in that when you look at it, and in one aspect, 1837, and it really kind of points back to SB 1079, there was this commitment to provide capital because, again, why? Nonprofits don't have the cash to do the deals, right, do the transactions. And so I think that there's a lot of hope surrounding what appears to be a $500 million commitment, which, hey, for grant funding, which is outstanding. It's incredible. But I think that one of the things that listeners kind of have to think about is, okay, we're talking about California, right? We're not talking about a city. We're gonna throw, oh, and by the way, at least if my reading is correct, it's not $500 million up front. It's $100 million over a five-year period. So without some lenient, well, I don't even want to use the word leniency. I think that without some thought about additional creative models, $100 million in a state where the average purchase price is $600,000. So if we roll that up to $1 million, so that's the impact of 100 units a year in California. So again, I think that to say, hey, if we just kind of put all of our hope on that, and then let alone some of the things that are in AB 1837, if passed. So we're going to get an outcome of 500 units, but then things kind of roll back to the status quo as to where they were. And I'm just not sure that's the desired outcome. And so, you know, if anybody from California is listening, talk to her. I really encourage you to talk to her. You know, let's not allow an article that presents three properties in a set way miss the larger discussion is that you guys need to talk to HUD, talk about their outcomes, talk about their experiences, and just kind of begin that conversation, because HUD is so far down the road in this space that I think that you could get a much better outcome following HUD guidelines. But yeah, so again, I'm not here to try to beat anybody up. I just want to make sure that I'm at least communicating that Southside, we've done things with HUD, no complaints ever. And, you know, we use the same methodology that we did with HUD as we did with SB 1079. And, we wish the California legislature the best, but I would really stress that we're not a bad actor. No complaints, and the California legislature could really use some consultation with the HUD HUD office, and I think they could really create a program, especially in a state like California where just prices are just astronomical. So,
interesting enough, I did have a call with the HUD asset sales office on actually some of the other transactions that Southside has been doing. They're probably open for a phone call, the interesting thing that you just mentioned is, the $500 million, that's a negligible amount in California. So they'll probably have very little impact. And what's frustrating for me is, what if AB 1837 goes into place? It's back to status quo. The only people that buy it for closure sale are investors.
Right.
Because they have 100% cash. And so that's not solving anything. It's going to be status quo, and where we have a chance to actually approve upon what's happening. By again, I've been saying it for forever, and so have you. Like, just follow HUD guidelines. It's not, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. They've been doing it for 15 years, and it's working great. Tim, thank you so much for being on the program. I really appreciate your feedback and the work that Southside is doing. And obviously we'll be talking very soon. But again, thanks so much for coming on.
Okay, thanks so much, Lewis.
Okay, we'll talk soon. That's it for this edition of Capital Markets Today. Thanks for tuning in. We look forward to talking more on housing and the mortgage market in future episodes. And we'll definitely keep an eye out on 1837. I think it's going to, I think we'll know by Wednesday next week to see how this is going to turn out. Again, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk next time.
Capital Markets Today is a leading industry content provider. Please visit Capital Markets Today at www.capital-mt.com for industry data, downloads, news, blogs, and to listen on demand to all past podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to Capital Markets Today on iTunes to have the latest podcasts downloaded to your smartphone automatically, giving you the flexibility to listen at your convenience.